Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
All right, angry music for angry people. Now, there's always kind of a competition for who's the angriest. Will Cosentini joins us from the Midwest. Will, how are you?
Angriest.
I don't think you are. I think you've kind of like mellowed in your old age. But Will takes pride on not so much his anger as his frankness with people. So Will joins us from McAllen, Texas. Tim Lynch is not known as an angry person, although he gets angry. Tim, how are you? How are things? You're having a butterfly infestation, I understand?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the monarch butterflies are in full migration. They're juvenile butterflies, but they are out in the backyard in the dozens. It's kind of cool.
Awesome. Well, congratulations on that. And then Jeff Kenny joins us. He's actually rather happy, which is uncharacteristic for him. Jeff, how are you?
Good, and I'm... I feel sorry for Timmy and his Mariposa, you know, attack he's underneath there, you know, his Papillon attack. But, yeah, so I'm doing good, though. I'm busy. I'm, like, in a good way, you know, so.
In a very diverse way.
Doing different things that don't have anything to do with each other.
That's why you're happy. You're busy. You don't have time to think about your miserable life.
That's right.
All right, I want to talk about leadership today. So I want to talk about people that influenced you. I don't know what made me think about this, but I love these conversations when we have them. So we'll start with Will, and we'll go around the table three times. Give me a leadership lesson that you learned from somebody, I'll leave it at that. Will, give me a leadership lesson you learned from somebody.
Yeah, number one, when I was at the basic school, you know, 6 months, and I don't know, 16,000 classes and everything else, but one that saved my ass many times and I try to impart to other people is how to be prepared. We were doing what we call the squad attacks in the NBC environment. And it started on a Monday morning. And so my group of lieutenants wanders up by LZ7, and our AI that day is Major Neller. And so they'd given all of us all of our NBC gear on Friday. And we, of course, chucked it into the corner of the BOQ room. And we're wandering up the hill, sort of trying to figure out how to put the hood on the gas mask and the booties tight and all this stuff. And you get up to the top of the hill and Major Neller is like dressed and covered and all ready. And he looks at us and we're a freaking soup sandwich, to say the least. And I'm just waiting for him to cook off. And he doesn't. And he goes through about a 30-minute soliloquy on how to make sure that you're prepared to do training, how your unit is prepared, how you supervise them. And I said, that could have just been another TBS Scream Fest, but it's something that I remember 35 years later. Be prepared and do the hard work to make sure that your unit is prepared and that you supervise it properly. So then Major Neller later coming out of the Marine Corps, obviously, a really good lesson.
Any thoughts on that, boys?
Well,
you don't have to. It's not mandatory. You could say no. Okay.
All right. That's from McAllen, Texas. No,
that's it's impressive. I'm sorry. Does somebody else want to go?
No, go ahead, Jeff.
Well, let me just finish then. General Neller. You know, I mean, I worked real close to the guy a couple times. That, you know, I really I love the guy. And he's, you know, for that type of stuff that Will mentioned, but. The other thing to that, that's kind of like, I think a lot of our leadership systems are going to go towards preparedness because, you know, that's like a key, you know, that's like a key factor in success. When I was enlisted, I had these two guys. One was a corporal who now is just guy I've mentioned a couple times, who's a stockbroker who owns a ranch in Texas, and that was a rough time in the Marine Corps, and he was one of these always prepared guys. And the thing that impressed me about him is we had no kidding racial animus in the barracks to the point where it got violent. And this guy, this is in the days when the duty NCO wore Charlies and had a duty belt. And this guy was a skinny guy, good shape, but and tough. You didn't know how tough, but he's the type of guy, he'd fight like the equivalent of, Evander Holyfield over who's going to clean the head. They're going to clean the fucking head because he's a duty NCO. Now, that doesn't seem like much, but back in those days, that's kind of like walking into a prison saying, I'm the boss now when you're a prisoner. And then the other guy was a gunny I had in Iran who was the same type of thing. He got there and we started doing react drills. I mean, there was not even an inkling then that there was going to be a takeover of the embassy. I mean, it's almost like he conjured it, you know. But he was that way. And then later he was my company gunny in 5th Marines. And it was just something I took forward with me, all the way through, when I became an officer. So that it hits home to me. And General Neller was that guy. He's that guy. Remember when he was the CG in 2006, there, the ground CG, we had this weird setup with a ground general and a civil affairs general and the overall general. And he was the ground guy. And he would put out these things. I think I mentioned it before. Where if you see he made us put decals on the Hummers. And if this decal didn't look like this, you're too far away. And if it didn't look like that, you're too close. It needed to look like C. It needs to look like this. Because he was convinced, I guess, from his experience, i.e. what Will just said, that people don't prepare right and they don't prepare their units right. And I'll tell you, I've seen it a lot and I'm still seeing it, unfortunately.
All right. Hey, go ahead.
Hey, Mac.
Yes.
The reason I hesitate to count a comment on General Neller is for all of my life, I could have sworn Neller was one of our instructors at TBS. And that he used to do this come out and in the morning do this big thing about WWE wrestling and the Hulkster and whatnot. But when he became Commandant, I looked at where he was and when he wasn't at teach at the basic school when I was there. I had mistaken him for Duffy White. It was Duffy he used to do that. So I have no comment now on Major Nelly because all my memories of him are false some damn reason.
All your
he's like the opposite of Duffy White.
No, it was just funny. Though, I could have sworn it was
Nelly. It's funny, though, that General Neller used to do that same shtick when he was there when I was a student at the basic school.
Then maybe I heard it and I confused the two, but he had left the basic school when I was a student, so I missed him, and that's why I don't comment.
He was there when I was a lieutenant. That's where I first crossed paths with him. All right, Tim, give me a leadership lesson, and who taught it to you?
Oh, if you want to get into the big ball game, you better know what the fuck you're doing. That's First Sergeant Lake, and First Sergeant Lake, I think it was one of my high school friends' fathers. And when I went to Quantico High School, I was a lacrosse player, and they have no lacrosse. And my dad said, well, you can't sit around the house because I've got to work, because it was just him and me. So he enrolled me in the Quantico Officials Association, which back in the late 70s dominated Northern Virginia softball and baseball. Dominated. And so I had no idea. I've never played baseball. But the very first Sunday I was there, I went to the AWS classroom every Sunday evening for 3 hours of a ground school in how to call a baseball and softball games. And I stuck with it because I had little else to do. And I actually got kind of good at it. But I was very, very good at technically calling balls and strikes. I kind of favored it. A lot of guys didn't. I felt like I was really good at it, but I screwed up once and caused a big ruckus with the coaches and whatnot. And First Sergeant Lake was called coach of first base. And he goes, you got talent, Lynch, but you got to know what the fuck you're doing before you come out here calling balls and strikes. And I've never forgotten that because it was true. I had not taken my responsibilities as serious as I should have and really wasn't as expert with the rules as I would become by my senior year in high school. That's my baseball secret. If I watch baseball, I'm watching the umpires. It's the only thing I understand.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Any comments? Be prepared. It seems like a theme here. All right, Jeff, give me a leadership lesson. Somebody taught you.
Well, the same guy, a gunny step guy, right? I'm in 3-5, and we're doing McCress exercise. In those days, now this guy had kind of I ran into him as a corporal in 1977 in Iran, and then I was back with him in 1979. He was our company gunny in 3-5. And so I became the state platoon sergeant, and we're running these two. And you guys, I think everybody knows Pendleton by now, all four of us. But you know, Horno Canyon, it's this Khyber Pass looking, you know, massive. It's got a little skinny pass through it, and it always was part of the McCress exercise in those days, which was new. I mean, before the Marine Corps is just getting back on its feet, and so the General Colonel Williams. From a Dido company commander, was our battalion commander. He wants a patrol to go up either side of the thing. So I had this guy, a corporal, who was kind of shitty. You know what I mean? His name was, I won't say his name. He might not be dead yet, you know, but anyway, I was going to run these two things up, and he's a senior guy. And I wasn't that experienced, you know, then really not about that stuff. And so I should have just gave him a, you know, I should have told him, hey, look, stay here with the technical gear that State Platoon had, and I'll put another corporal who was junior to him in charge. But I thought that, I mean, for some reason, I thought that that wasn't an option. So, you know, in those days, we had sea rats. I mean, I might be arrested after this story. But anyway, in those days, we had sea rats. And you could take a sea rat, you could use your John Wayne. It's basically a can opener that comes in every case of sea rats. And you could make a stove. And you could heat water and make coffee. And that's the only time I never heated up an MRE in my whole life or a sea rat. I just did the coffee. Well, the only thing we had in common was he was a coffee man too. So he's heating his coffee. I'll tell you what, I went over and I was like, I was very proud of my platoon. I didn't want us to show our ass. So I got a heat tab and I scraped it off with my thumbnail like a little smidge, and I dropped it in his coffee without hopefully not being seen. And he drank. I knew he would say, as soon as he felt the slightest nausea, he would beg off. And he did. And I put the next guy in charge. So now it's like we go to Oki. We're like the third battalion to go to Oki, like about a month and a half after that. And about by February of 1980, March of 1980, we're doing pretty good there in Okinawa. You know, it's my first time in Okinawa, and it's like great. And it's in a CTA when there was still, like, you know, wilderness in the CTA. And they tell me I got to take a reporter with me when I go, a reporter for the, you know, that newspaper at Okinawa. So I take, I'm bitching about it, and my guys hear me bitch. I'm like, I don't fucking want this guy. In those days, the state, even now, State Platoon worked for the S2. I'm telling the two chief, I don't want this guy. I tell you, frankly, I don't always stay in the training areas that I got signed out. I don't want this guy in my mind, I thought he would put it in the newspaper. Sergeant Kenny is in the Nike missile area when he's not supposed to be here. You know, I don't know what I was thinking. But anyways, I meet the guy, and he's like 30-year-old sergeant. I was like 22 then, 22-year-old sergeant. And he's a good fucking guy. And we're out there, and of course it pours rain on us. We do a couple patrols. We put up poncho hooches, and he's in there hooching with me. And he's a good dude, and so we're going out. We're coming back, and we're doing shifts and stuff. And I did go to the Nike missile site, you know. And I'm, you know, we're doing combat sketches and everything. And he starts getting sick, and I'm like, fuck. And he's like throwing up so bad that I thought that's the first medevac I did. 46 came and picked him up. And so then now it's a month later. We're in the Philippines. We're in the Sky Club. If any of you guys been to the Philippines, there's the Sky Club up there at the Upper Mao Camp. And I'm drinking with some of my guys, and they go, hey, Sergeant Kenny, you should buy us Mojo all night. Remember that Mojo shit?
Right.
And I go, why should I buy you Mojo? I will, because you guys don't have any sense when it comes to money, but why should I? Because we did a favor for you, man. And he said, man, we poisoned that fucking Stars and Stripes guy or whatever he was. You know, I'm like, we saw you do it to Corporal, what's his name? And I'm like, my eyes got big like Roy Scheider in Jaws. He's on the beach and he sees the, you know, and that's how I felt. And I'm like, fuck, it's not a good idea to poison your dudes. And,
That's a great leadership lesson.
That is that's an awesome leadership lesson.
So I'm like, you got to, if you get an order you don't want to do, you still got to do it. Especially if you're men here, you get it. And that happens over and over through your career. Because if you fuck off on the guy above you, they will fuck off on you, sure as shit. I mean, that's what that hit home to me. So I've never poisoned another Marine since. And, you know, and I always do what the guy above me says, no matter how dumb it is.
I just had that conversation yesterday with somebody saying that,
Jeff Penny poisoned somebody?
Not that one. No, you weren't going to jail before today, so you'd kept that one close to the vest. But, no, them saying that I'm following in the wake of somebody who would broadcast their dissent all over the place. And and now all these people that are subordinates, that's how they do business now. He said, and it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare. So now I've got to teach, like, this is how you dissent, right?
Mm-hmm.
You owe somebody your honest opinion, and then there's a salute point. And once you hit the salute point, you salute, and you execute their order just like it was your own. And everybody beneath you shouldn't see either side of that. They should just see, hey, this is what we're doing. And he said, because that hasn't been the case, I got to tell you, it's a nightmare right now. Because they think they have the right to dissent and drag their feet and all this other bullshit. And so, very interesting. Tim?
That is interesting. That is very interesting. Good point.
All right.
Yeah, it's just because the mission is horrible and it's high risk doesn't mean you don't do it. I mean, you attempt to use because your boss is not going to have the same tactical feel in your area that you do. You attempt to modify it to achieve the same objectives that he wants. But in the end, the organization works by you doing what you're told to do, assuming it's moral, ethical, legal order.
Right.
I Jeff brings it home in a very, in your face kind of way. But if anybody thinks that they can get away with that stuff and people below them don't pick up on it, they're idiots.
Right.
Unless you're poisoning somebody and don't tell anybody else. That's not a bad move. I like it.
But it's amazing. I should have jumped up on it, didn't they?
No, let me just tell you. But how would you call that? The whole litany of things that happen, right?
Yeah.
As when you get outside, when you get outside the group. And they don't want you, and whether real or perceived, Marine Corps a cruel place.
Yeah.
And yes,
it is.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. No, it is.
Well, it's like after Will left Lima Company, I became the XO, and we got a new company commander, new battalion commander, new XO of the battalion, and those guys thought they were a cat's ass, and they weren't. And my company commander I had was not as good as the guy that me and Will had. But he wasn't the worst guy in the world. But the leadership of the battalion wanted rid of him, and they kept putting pressure on us in the company, in the officers in the company, first and foremost me, to give ammo for him to be fired. And I resisted it. I mean, he got all the way through, and I'll tell you, it wasn't easy because compared to the guy we had before, he was not good. So it was a constant. It was like 18 months of agony, with that, having that situation. And again, in my memory was this incident I had with, when I was enlisted guy, and it wasn't easy. And the guy who was the chief proponent of trying to do damage to this captain's career was our battalion XO, who later was fired as a battalion commander, for abusing junior people. So it's like, there's something good in all those people, but they none of them were as good as they thought they were, And so it was, and all of them thought that what they were doing was justified. And I found out from that guy who I made sick, and especially from the sergeant from from the base newspaper that ain't true at all.
Interesting. This is not in any particular order, but one of the first leadership lessons I learned, and Jeff kind of alluded to this, was about seniority. And it was kind of a few lessons in one. I had a sergeant whose older brother was a gunny who I think his dad got out as a sergeant major. But anyway, his name is Tony Jarrett. And he was a hard-charging sergeant, and he was good. And so my platoon sergeant, now I'm a second lieutenant, we're getting ready to deploy. My platoon sergeant is going to school to get his high school diploma. And so I need a platoon sergeant. And I want Jarrett to be the platoon sergeant. I had another sergeant, and I won't say his name, but he was senior to Jarrett. And so I went over to talk to our battalion sergeant major. And his last name was Sakamano. He had fought in Korea. And he's a rifleman in Korea. And so the Marines used to call him Pop Sakamano, his big Italian guy. And he would call the battalion to attention, and it sounded like this. You couldn't understand the things he said. And so he would say, this is the calling the battalion attention. And everybody.
Like, you never go wrong coming to attention.
Right. We don't know what he's saying, but we kind of do. And nobody had the balls to say, like, I don't understand what he's saying, right? We just did it. So anyway, I go over there. I'm the junior lieutenant of the battalion. Knock on his hatch. Boom, boom, boom. He looks up. Yeah, lieutenant, what can I do for you? And so I introduce myself. Sergeant Major, I'm Lieutenant McNamara. I'm, third platoon commander over at Charlie Company. And he says, that's great. He said, how long you been here? I said, I've been here like 4 months. I said, and I came over because I got a question for you. What role does seniority play? I got to replace my platoon sergeant. And what role does seniority play in who I choose? And he looked at me and said, well, he said, I got to tell you, if I had to wait till I was senior to my peers to get the jobs I had in the Marine Corps, he said, I wouldn't have got half of them. He said, so what do you owe your Marines? You owe them the best leadership. Now, if it's close, the senior guy should get the opportunity first. But if it's not close, you owe them the best leadership. And I was a little bit stunned. I thought when I went over there, he was going to say, seniority is important. You got to let the senior guy do it. That's not what he said. I was so excited. So I learned two lessons. One of them was, to go seek counsel. I mean, and I'm a second lieutenant. Don't be afraid to go ask, leaders what they think. And so that was a good experience for me. And then the other one that was another good experience was the whole, kind of Jeff alluded to, I didn't think I could do that, but and so Tony Jarrett became my platoon sergeant, and he was awesome. He was a great platoon sergeant. He wound up getting out as master gunnery sergeant. And I saw him in Iraq in 2006. I come walking around the corner and he looks up, he goes, holy shit. And I said, Master Guns, what's up? And so, no, but it was two good, really good lessons for me as a young guy about, going and asking questions. And then, you'll probably be surprised at the quality of advice that you get. So, anybody's thoughts on that?
I had identical experience in my first time in the fleet. I mean, virtually identical. Yeah.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, number two. Second leadership lesson you've learned from somebody.
Yeah, this one I think is learned and relearned, but a real, to me, sort of an epic story. I was a three in 1-2, and we deployed in 1997, split ARG, and we went down to Africa because there was going to be a massive coup in Kinshasa, Zaire, and we went ashore into Brazzaville, Congo. And nothing happened, got back on the ship, and now we're transiting up the coast of Africa, and the embassy in Sierra Leone basically gets overrun, and we need to evacuate it. So we went in on the first day and took a couple of hundred people out of there and thought we're done. On the second day, we're off the coast still. They say, hey, you got to go back. You left some people there. We said, okay. We went back on the third day now. We took some people out, and now we're done. We go back. And on the fourth day, so the situation is there's a government force, there's a rebel force, and there's a West African peacekeeping intervention force
Echo Mug
are having a three-way firefight at night in and around the grounds of the Mamiyoko Hotel. And the hotel is on fire. And we get the order from UConn that we're going to fast rope onto the roof of this hotel into a three-way firefight and rescue about 500 people that are trapped in the basement of this hotel. And my battalion commander is a guy named Tom Green, who was Jeff's MU commander later.
Right.
And I told Colonel Greenwood, I said, "Sir, I'll have people ready to do this, but we can't do it." And Tom Greenwood went into the LFOC, and I don't know what he said. I can imagine. But he basically told the MU commander, and he told whoever the one-star general who was, projecting 5,000 miles south with his screwdriver, told him, "We ain't doing it because it's stupid."
Tell everybody, explain to everybody what the LFOC is.
The Landing Force Operations Center. So the combat information, the combat operations center on board the ship, on board Kearsarge.
Got it.
And we could have done that for sure. There would have been dead Marines, dead Nigerians, dead Sierra Leone government forces, dead rebels, and a bunch of dead civilians. Not a doubt in my mind. And so the next day, we actually went ashore, and we took like 1,200 people out of there, and nobody got hurt. And every single one of the people in the basement of that hotel got out of there. And so this is a little contrary to you do what you're told to do, but sometimes it takes guts. And I got to tell you, it takes a lot of guts to be a lieutenant colonel telling the colonel, MU commander, the one-star general, and for all I know, the four-star at UConn, that this is beyond stupid. And Tom Greenwood had guts. And that, it resonated with me, and I would like to think that I would have done some of the same stuff. But sometimes when you're the leader, you got to have guts. I think a lot of lieutenant colonels would have done what they were told and would have been a freaking disaster. Not a doubt in my mind. But that guy, we accomplished the entire mission. Nobody got hurt and no one's ever heard of it. So.
Right.
And that does take guts because you don't know how it's going to come out on the other end. You don't know if you're going to be able to get those folks when you make that. So it does take guts, the guts of facing the unknown consequence, you know?
Right. Especially, and again, there's another impact, and that is on your career. And so you're sitting there and you're thinking, well, if I say no to this, like, how does this, is this the end of my career? Like, yeah, I'm pushing back on this. And it's not just a tactical situation. It's like, I'm going to walk in and say this, you know, am I going to, will I still be in charge? What are they going to do when I push back on their big idea? And so, as Will said, that comes with no small amount of risk, professionally when you do that stuff. But let me tell you, if you can't, I don't care what organization you're a part of. If you can't stand up and tell the truth, then it ain't worth being a part of. If that's the cost of being part of something, it ain't worth it. And you'll find a lot of people that they'll say that, yeah, I think that's wrong. Well, did you say anything? Well, no, I didn't say anything. Interesting. Any other comments, Timmy?
No, that's a great story, though.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you turn down an opportunity to fast rope into a building and you get to shoot everybody because everybody's shooting at you? Fuck, that was kind of cool.
Hopefully never.
I know.
All right, Timmy, your second leadership lesson.
This is an easy one. It comes from Colonel Brown. I think he retired as a major general. He was the CO of First Marines when I was the XO of Charlie 19, and Major Mike Lowe, who one of the finest officers I've ever met, was our three, and he had called me up there and he said, "Hey, Lynch, I need 15,000 rounds of 5.56 ball because I just got three slots to the combat rifle instructor course, but I need them like right now." I said, I don't have any ranges ordered this week, sir. We don't have any ammunition ordered. He said, "Yeah, I already know that, Lynch." I said, "I need my fucking ammo. I need it now." And I'm like, "What?" He goes, "Lynch, go get me my ammo." So I took my sergeants and we went out in between that area, in between a Horno area and the SOI, and dug up our stash and put him in my trunk of my car. And actually, I think I had to go to my garage to get the rest of it. But we got together enough rounds and came back. And I was opening up my trunk to haul him up to the S3. And I look over my corner, and here's comes Colonel Brown just strolling around the area. I slammed the trunk and I turned around and salute. Good morning, sir. Morning, Lieutenant Lynch. He goes, do you know what good judgment comes from? And I said, no, sir, I don't. He goes, it comes from using bad judgment. You learn. I said, oh. And he looked at me, and he kept on looking at me. Then he smiled, and he sauntered off, and I thought I was dead. I'm like, oh, shit, I got busted on this one. I haul it up to Major Lowe, and he starts laughing his ass off. But I think the lesson there isn't necessarily that good judgment comes from exercising bad judgment. The lesson I learned from that particular time in the Marine Corps was having a chain of command you could trust. Trust going up and down the chain of command, because when you're in a battalion that is functioning on all cylinders, it's a beautiful goddamn thing. And nobody wants to be on the outs in that kind of an outfit. It's a startling contrast to what you're talking about earlier with people who bitched a lot. Because I remember we used to get hammered, asked to do all kinds of stuff on a short lease. And one time I was bitching to Captain Hummer, Steve Hummer, who was the Bravo, and Hummer goes, listen, let me tell you something, Lieutenant Lynch. When you've got a good horse, sometimes you got to ride it, and you got to ride it, and you got to ride it, because you ain't got no more good horses. And I like being one of the good horses. And that was – I thought that was pretty profound. So that was a mini lesson out of a more relevant lesson, which is trust up and down a chain of command. When it's established properly, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Yeah, you know, back in the day – you know, before computers and before barcodes and stuff like that, you know, people had stashes, right? I mean, you would see supply organizations where they're going through phase mo. They're burying stuff out in the back. They're calling other warehouses. Hey, man, I need this. And right? I mean, that's the way they did it. And, you know, and then they tell the lieutenant, like, hey, sir, you need to go away this afternoon. Okay, we've got some shit to do if we're going to get through this phase mo. Really? Okay, Gunny, I'm out of here. And they would do their shit. I don't think it works like that so much anymore. I think that thing's pretty well buttoned up these days. Interesting, though.
Man, I think Colonel Brown knew exactly what I was doing. He certainly could have seen enough of my trunk to understand there was nothing in there but 5.56 ammo boxes. I think he knew exactly. But at the same time, we got three sergeants going to the combat, you know, rifle instructors course, which is a big deal. That seemed to have priority, you know?
Right. All right, Jeff, your third lesson?
Well, I'm going to stick with the company level stuff because a lot of people, there's still people in the Marine Corps who I don't want to, you know, darn mom. So anyways, I have the job that Will had. I mean, it's another MEW workout. We did two back-to-back MEWs. And we go to AP Hill. And I put together, and this happened when I was with Will, and that first, we got good at doing like, okay, we got a little range. You only got so much space. And so we're going to take a rifle squad, put a machine gun team with it, have them assault, and then have a small team come up and take out a bunker. We mix it up, you know. So we were doing that, something very much like that, one of those great ranges, relatively speaking, they had at AP Hill in those days. And so I go up to sign out the range the day before, and there's Army dudes ran the range control. And there's a Staff Sergeant Ramirez, Army guy, and he's talking to another guy as I'm signing out the range. He goes, yes, he says, and he had a Hispanic accent. He goes, I had to tell that little 81st platoon commander what was what. He was coming in here wanting to do this and that. I fucking told him, you know, Marine. So the guy he's talking about is Joe Rutledge, who is a buddy of mine, you know, and Wills. I'm like, you motherfucker. But I don't say anything because I got to sign out my range. So I go to the range and we the next day we kick this thing off. Squad, all the squad, every single squad in Lima Company 3-8. And we're up one, and my company commander is off doing like something with the battalion staff. And so I was there the whole day. It was raining and everybody is cold. It was like November, late November. So it's kind of snowing a little bit and everybody's there with their, they got, some of them have their watch caps jammed under their helmets and wearing gloves that have holes in them, and everybody's got snot dripping out of their nose and shit. And we're about to, it was a good day though, you know, and up pulls this pickup, range control pickup, and out pops this guy, Staff Sergeant Ramirez. He comes up to me and goes, "Sir, you cannot do this type of weapons together on this range." So I'm looking at him, and there's like a little crowd of the lieutenants and the staff sergeants, you know, and the company gunny who we had, and they're all standing like a little rough semicircle. I look at this guy, and I'm thinking, I go, "You know, Staff Sergeant, I got one more squad to run through this. I'm going to fucking do it. And I don't give a shit what you do." I'm poking him in the chest with my finger. "I don't give a shit what you do, because I'm going to be out here. I'll never fucking come back to AP Hill again." I found out that was wrong, and I'm poking him. And I go, "So just, you can get the fuck out of here." My guys laugh at him.
I should have gave him the coffee.
His face turns beet red. He's humiliated. He fucking leaves, right? He leaves. We finish. And then we're like echeloning the battalion back to Lejeune. And remember I told you the situation with my company commander was kind of like in the crosshairs of our battalion staff. And so we come up missing a goddamn spare barrel. And in those days, a spare barrel for a SAW would get him fired. You know, they would use that as a reason.
Right.
So I'm like, "Motherfucker, who do I know up at AP Hill?" I'm racking my brains. I can't remember anybody except this guy, Staff Sergeant Ramirez.
Oh, shit.
So I call range control. I go, "Hey, Staff Sergeant Ramirez, this is Lieutenant Kenny from 3-8. You remember me?" He goes, "Oh, yes, sir. I fucking remember you." And I go, "Well, I need you to do a favor for me." And he laughs. And I go, "Look, Staff Sergeant, I'm a fucking asshole, all right? I shouldn't have went off on you like that. But this situation I got here, it's some guy who had nothing to do with that. He's going to be the one who pays for it. So I'm just asking, you know, I know right where this thing is because I got the platoon sergeant and I got the SAW gunner." And he remembered. He left it under one of those racks in a big tent they had at APL. And the guy goes, "Where is it, sir?" So I tell him. He goes and he calls me back. He goes, "I got it." And I go, he goes, "Just have one of your, come on up and get it." So I sent the platoon sergeant and the kid, you know, the SAW gunner up there to get it. I said, "Hey, Staff Sergeant, what do you drink?" And he goes, "Ron Rico, rum." So I got a big, like, handle of that shit. And I gave it to platoon sergeant. I said, "Make sure this guy gets it." And, you know, I said to myself, I really fucked that up. But this guy redeemed it because he's a better person than me. And so that really, you know, affected me. Always do a favor for somebody you get a chance if he's wearing an American uniform, because you never know that when that'll come back to help you. You know, it's like a favor bank. I read a book. I can't remember the name of it now, but there's this, the guy references a favor bank. You do a favor for somebody and the chances are, even if the people don't know each other, if they're military people, someone will do a favor for you and you really need it. And sooner or later, you're going to need one. So that was something that sticks out in my mind from those days.
Now, the favor bank, I think, is huge. You know, yeah. I think it's just part of being a good citizen. The my second one is a lesson from watching General Mattis. And so I'd been out of the Marine Corps for 10 years. I come back on active duty. I'm supposed to be in division plans, and General Mattis's aide gets wounded, and General Kelly comes to me and says, "You're going to be General Mattis's staff sec." And I said, "I don't even know what that is." And he goes, "Don't worry about it. It's a better job than this." I said, "Who do I work for?" He said, "The chief of staff, Joe Dunford." I'm like, "Who's he?" He's like, "Mac, you're an idiot." And I said, "I don't know him." And he said, "He's from Boston. You'll love him." And I said, "I hate people from Boston." And he goes, "Look, just shut up and come with me." So I worked for Kelly for a few months at IOC. He was there when I went there. And then John Allen showed up. But anyway, so I mean, I got a pretty interesting, for about 6 months, a pretty interesting seat to watch leadership of a Marine Corps division in combat. And one of the things I learned, you know, and I'll categorize it under no attrition, no morale. I think there's a level that you get to that you have got to be, I don't want to say lean into, but maybe that's what I should say. You have to lean into firing people. Because what I saw in the division was the division had a lot of good, You know, I mean, Will was a battalion commander. Paul Kennedy was a battalion commander. You know, we had, you know, we had a whole bunch of guys who would become, go on to become general officers, were staff guys. But they would initially come back as battalion commanders and do great things. But what General Mattis was, in my opinion, very successful at was he scared the non-great performers, which are the majority of leaders in the Marine Corps. He scared the shit out of those guys and women. And they performed at a high level because they were scared shitless that he would come get them. And so I didn't really know if I understood. I mean, I had fired people in my life. But I kind of thought I got a better understanding of why it's important for a larger organization to get rid of the non-performers, okay? And he did that. He was more than willing to do that. And I know because I used to get him, and he'd say, "Max, send him back to CONUS." I'd say, "Yes, sir." And you'd have some lieutenant colonel showing up with all of his shit packed in a sea bag, you know. And so... I thought that was important, and under the phrase "no attrition, no morale," if you allow the fools to continue along, right, and do foolish things, you hurt the whole organization. You are better off with a younger, better leader in that position, and you're better off sending a message that you better perform, or else you're going to be gone. And I learned that from him. I would have probably, before I watched that, I would have probably said, "Oh, you know, you got to give people more than one chance," and blah 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 blah. I think there's certain rails that you touch that you get like 1 1/4 chances on, and if you show that you just don't get it, or you can't do it, or you don't take care of people, to me, you get 1 1/4 chances, especially in that environment, because we're playing you bet your life. So I to me, the whole phrase, no attrition, no morale, and it means that, hey, subpar leaders, they got to go, and they got to go in a hurry, and that gives everybody else hope. So because you when you see that this guy's not good, and all of a sudden he's gone, what do you believe? Like, hey, somebody knows what the fuck they're doing, man, because that guy should have gone away. So anyway, for what it's worth, any comments about that? All right.
No, but I've seen organizations that didn't do that, and it's pretty obvious when you leave the dry rot in place. It's not pleasant.
Oh, it's painful.
Mm-hmm.
It's painful, yeah, Jeff.
And we all know of people who should have got relieved but didn't, and we know others of people who didn't deserve to get relieved but did because the leadership didn't have that ethos that you just. Delineated there, Max. So that's another part of this. And I'll tell you, when we get to the book part, this has become a theme. I'm listening. You ask these questions. What's your leadership? You know, memories and everything. The most compelling things are all coming to this type of thing. It's basically a combination of preparedness and loyalty, up and down. Because that's what it is when you fire a guy who's bad. It's loyalty down. You know, because that comes home to people who know the guy's fucked up. Because I'll tell you, I'm talking to these two, my stepson and his buddy from 1-5 yesterday at the Memorial Park, and they're talking about guys who were fucked up but got all the way through it, you know, got through and didn't get exposed, and it's not good for the unit, you know. Then they get a good guy and things get better, you know. But it's like, right. if you send that message, I agree with you, Mac. You know that it improves morale and it makes people think, if I do good, I'll get treated good. If I do bad, I'll be gone. And that's what you need among leadership for sure.
Well, and I will tell you this. I mean, it's not like he would see one thing and he would smoke somebody. He would see one thing and he would start making phone calls to people that he trusted and say, "Hey, look, I need you to give me an honest assessment. You come in contact with this guy. What do you think? Because here's what I saw. Am I wrong about that?" And those are delicate conversations, right? Because you don't want to be disloyal to somebody, right? Because you owe them your loyalty. So, or you send other people down to say, "Hey, I need you to take a look." But there's certain rails, you know. That I mean, for instance, if you show up and Marines are living like pigs. I mean, that is like, that's a Roman candle. Somebody got to go, because that's not how we do it. And you're, you know, and if the cleanliness is like that, just start flipping rocks and see what else you find. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. Will, number three.
I think this is sort of about trust and mission orders, but I'm not sure. So when I was second lieutenant, went to Okinawa, one of my squads got involved in the 3rd Marine Division squad competition, which used to be a big deal.
Right.
And so my whole company went down to the Philippines for about 3 months, and I trained a squad to be in this competition up in the NTA in Okinawa. And so we won that competition, and you get to go to 8th and I, and everyone gets a special award for it. It so happened to be that we only had a month left in the deployment then, so we just went down and joined our rear party, or our advance party, who had come back from Okinawa. So I'm back down at Geiger, me, a squad of Marines, and, you know, like the S4 Alpha and those guys. And we're cleaning out the squad bays, and we got all these old wall lockers. And so the supply officer says, hey, just a DRMO over on main side. Yeah, sure. Put them on the truck. Off they go. About 3 months later, he comes to me and says, hey, Will, did you get that receipt from DRMO for those wall lockers? And I don't know what DRMO is. I actually didn't go. We put them on a truck, and I said, no, I don't have it, Roy. And he says, well, I got to have those things, or someone's going to have to pay for them. And I looked them up, and of course, you know, obsolete, banged up Marine Corps wall lockers that are just going to go in the scrap heap cost about $1,000 a piece.
Of course.
You know, so I'm in hock for about 30 grand here. And it just so happens that we had a brand new second lieutenant who had just checked in named Neil Pugliese, and Jeff knows him well. And I say, hey, Neil, I need you to go over to DRMO and find this receipt. And first of all, we're at Geiger at Lejeune. We never went to Mainside.
Right.
I don't know where DRMO is. And in those days, a receipt was a 5-carbon thing. So somewhere in the Defense Reutilization Management Office in some dump over at Mainside, amongst 150 filing cabinets, is this receipt that's worth $30,000 to me. And I'm thinking, off he goes. About 6 hours later, he comes bouncing in. Hey, XO, I got your receipt. I never, in my wildest dream, thought he was going to find this thing. And I learned something there that, you know what? Sometimes you get a good guy, and he just goes and does it.
Yeah.
And that was like, I wouldn't have assigned that, because he probably had to burrow through the 5th carbon copy of 150 filing cabinets worth of crap to find, right? No first lieutenant would have gone and done it. No sergeant would have gone and done it. But a brand new second lieutenant just went and did it. And it was sort of, I thought back on that many times throughout my life, that don't underestimate junior people, and don't underestimate trusting people to go do things that are difficult sometimes. That's always tempered with judgment and everything else. But I said, sometimes you give someone a task and they will surprise you with how well they perform it. And I saw it as a battalion commander. I saw it in the civilian world, the business world. And so be a little humble that you're not the smartest person there, that someone else might be able to figure something out that you think is impossible. And give someone an opportunity to do a shitty job, and it's unbelievable what they might do for you.
Now, did he find the receipt, or did they make another one?
Oh, no. He found it. It was wadded up, barely legible, et cetera, et cetera. Or he was smart.
Wait, say it again, or what? Oh, we lost Will. Connection lost.
Smart enough. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're cutting in and out.
Okay, I got you loud and clear.
Right. That means you're the problem.
Still here?
Yes.
Sorry.
That's all right.
What do you want me to do?
Continue to speak.
Yeah, so maybe this guy was smart enough to go over to the exchange and screw off, and at the last minute pull up there and said, hey, can you recopy your receipt? If he is, he's smarter than me.
No way.
I don't know.
No. No. It's interesting that you know, there's so much – sometimes, you know, you approach life with a jaundiced eye based on your experience, and you give somebody a chance, and that's one of those things, especially when you're junior, don't be afraid to put your hands up and say, hey, can I try that? Will you give me a shot at that? And it's pretty amazing what you'll find out about people. So that's interesting. Timmy, any other comments about that?
Nope, but I'll move on to my next one. Right. And it's a simple one. It's lead by example. And that's not an easy concept to understand unless you're with Marines and you're in just a shit situation. And in my experience in the Marine Corps, because I had retired by 2000, that was always bad weather. And extended periods of bad weather when you're out exposed to it 24/7 takes a little bit of discipline and a little bit of work and effort to keep yourself able to go. You got to tend to your feet. You've got to get food. You know, you've got to get your rest. It's a challenging situation, and you throw in snow and ice and cold on top of that. Like, let's say one of those stupid Valen Usher things in Korea in November. It can be traumatic. And I watched, as a lieutenant, I watched battalions during their request cycles when we were evaluating fold from 5 days of bad weather in Northern California or Korea. So one of the things that I learned that just always stuck with me is, as long as I wasn't whiny or cranky or miserable about it, generally my Marines weren't going to bitch too much because they know I'd sit there and tease them about it. But it really slammed home to me after I left the Marine Corps. When I stood up the Embassy Guard Force in Kabul, our living arrangements were shit. It was a horrible situation. We never had enough food and a chow hall and stuff like that because we couldn't eat at the embassy or anything. It was ridiculous. And there were often times I didn't eat, and I would tell the guys, "No, I'm the guy in charge. I eat last, and don't worry about it." And that's we've all done that at Thanksgiving in the field with the Marines and whatnot. That's not exactly a big deal. It wasn't like I couldn't send Haji around the corner for a kebab and some rice, which was better anyway. But just the fact that was the way I felt really made a difference, particularly once you're outside the Marine Corps, because the Marines expect you to eat last and expect you to lead by example. That's an expectation, not some kind of revelation, you know. But it really translated well in the outside world in the unusual role of a civilian contractor, and I imagine it does in many other places too.
Well, I'll tell you a C story. I'm the XO on the Ranger, and I get off duty. I've been up in CIC all night, but I'm done up there. So I come down, and the ship store, we had two ship stores. We had one, I don't know, on some level, and then one on the main deck. And so I go down there, and, you know, there's two lines. There's the, you know, there's a line for, you know, all the enlisted sailors and Marines. And there's a head of the short line, the head of the line privileges people. So I'm off duty now, essentially, because I'm off my watch time, which was when we were within 50 miles of the Iranian coast. You know, we manned all the external guns. And then when we came off that, or, you know, if I'd been up there all night, my CO, Rich Christie, he'd go up there and then I'd go to sleep. So I come down, I get in line. Now, you see these sailors kind of looking at me like I'm a dumb fuck, right? So I stand in line for about 20 minutes, and I get like halfway to the hatch. And the chief's mess was right across the passageway. These chiefs, so they roll out, right, in their khakis, you know, straining at the belt with a toothpick in their mouth, and they roll into the store. And here these guys are in coveralls, right? Dirty as shit. Whether they're engineers or aviation mechanics working on shit. And they've been up all night turning wrenches. And they're trying to get some Oreos or something to go to bed and eat or whatever. And so you're just standing in line. And so I stood in line for about 20 minutes and got halfway to the door. The guy in front of me turns around and he goes, "You know, Lieutenant, you have headline privilege." And I said, "I know." And with that, all these heads turned. Ooh. And they said, "What do you mean, you know? Why wouldn't you just walk in front of the line?" I said, "Because we don't do that in the Marine Corps. Now, if I was on duty and I hadn't eaten and I had to come down here and get something to eat, I'd do that. But when I'm not on duty, your time is just as important to me as my time, arguably more important. So I'll stand in the back of the line and take my turn." And then they started into this discussion of, "Why the fuck isn't the Navy like that?" I said, "I don't know. I don't know. We're different. Okay? We eat last. We go last." And they're like, "Shit, right? Everything we do, they go first." I'm like, "Yeah, it's a little bit different culture." So it was an interesting, I mean, again, as a first lieutenant aboard a ship serving with a different service, although there are sister service, it was very interesting and very, and you know, brought home to me very acutely how much they appreciated that. And so they looked at me like, "So you're going to stand in this line till you get in?" I said, "That's the way it goes, boys." And they're like, "That's awesome." And then whenever I'd see this group of guys are on the ship, they'd be like, "Hey, Lieutenant Mapp, what's up?" They were my ship store buddies. But you know, but it was like, you know, the respect they showed for the culture because, you know, geez, well, that's cool. You guys respect your Marines and you show it by doing that. And they thought that was really cool. So it was interesting. Interesting. All right. Jeff, your third one.
I thought I did three already.
Well, that's what happens when you have a head injury.
Yeah.
You've done two. Are you out?
No, I'm not out. I could run my suck all day, you know? I got to say, are we going to do three? Like, are we going to do people which one are we doing here?
Oh,
the,
because
we did the incidents, but I could do a General
no,
Smith story.
It was, we'll go around the wheel three times on this.
Right.
Three leadership lessons you learned from someone.
Right.
So this is number three.
Okay. I got it. And all so, right. General Smith was our regimental commander in 8th Marines and I was a lieutenant. And he was the guy who – he was still lieutenant colonel. When I graduated IOC, he was the speaker at our graduation. And so I go down to Lejeune. I've never been to Lejeune before in my career. I was, Pendleton, 29 Palms and overseas and stuff like that, embassy duty. And so So I'm at Lejeune here, and just like Will was saying, we're at Camp Geiger, separated from the rest of the division. And we got this guy as a regimental commander who was a kind of a brilliant guy, General Sheehan. And he was like a huge tall guy, like 6 foot something. And they had like it was a mixture of 8th Marines at Geiger and SOI folks. So there's weird speed limits. Like your average speed limit is 25 miles, but by the regiment it was 15. And somehow, in his head, he could calibrate cars going by faster than that. And he ran out and flagged down my wife with my kids in the van for going like she's going 30 miles an hour in a 50 mile zone. And he found out who I was, and I got my ass chewed. I mean, I wasn't even there a little while. And so it wasn't a bad dash to him. It was like, you know, hey, General Sheehan. Matter of fact, his nickname then was Shitfinger Sheehan because he would check the heads and he would scrape his fingers along the commode and shit, you know? I mean, I'm sure Will, he probably had way more experience with him than me. Like one time, I think Captain Ratliff, our CO, comes in the morning like 6:30, quarter seven, and sitting at his desk is Colonel Sheehan, you know? So he's kind of, you know, it was a certain type of leadership. Well, I'm there about a month, and we did something in the field. I can't remember which thing it was, but it was in what they call the Verona Loop training area. And we find out, hey, we're getting – and to me, I just found out that day we're going to have Etul Smith, who just got promoted colonel, is going to be our regimental commander. We did the You remember, Will, we did a change of command in the field for that. And it was in a shitty LZ out there in the Verona Loop area. No wives, no band, no none of that shit, right? And I mean, I don't know if you can get away with that. Although today we got coronavirus. Then we just had the crappiness of Verona Loop, you know. But he did that, and then he made himself known, you know, with his PMEs and stuff. And he seemed like he knew everybody's name. And he was a regimental commander for about a year. We came back from float. And I had just become a first lieutenant near the end of our float. So now I'm no longer a battalion duty. Now I'm going to be regimental duty, right? I'm a battalion XO. So I'm in there, and he calls me from the club. And he says, "Hey, Kenny, listen, you're going to get a bunch of phone calls from people, but there is a couple teenagers on a boat. One of them is our commo. And I'm sure Will was gone by this time. And that boat turned over, and I think both these kids are dead. But there's going to be a huge thing of, you know, searching going on tomorrow. I want you to handle the whole thing." So, and the reason in those days, just like First Marines at the same time, Timmy knows this, 8th Marines had all the rubber boats and rigid raiders in the, you know, for the MUSOC outfits. So I did it, man. I went and I got all these dudes, and you know, I was calling people, and the next day we got this little flotilla to go look for this, you know, look for this girl. And the, I think the boy might have survived, but the girl, they were looking for the girl, and they eventually, like a week later, she washed up somewhere down the river, but you know, dead. But he just put total total trust in me doing it. And like the general came down, and then he comes down, and everyone's congratulating him on busting his ass and getting all the assets for the you know, down there on the river. And he said, "Hey, Lieutenant Kenny here did it. You know, all I did is call him. I was actually half buzzed when I did and told him to do it." So what I remember about that was trust. You know, he had trust in kind of like Will and Pug. Because Pug, I took my first rifle platoon from the guy Will was talking about, Puglisi, Neil Puglisi. And so, you know, we're all together there. And it was we had good leadership. You know, sometimes they're hard. Like the battalion commander we had before we had Colonel Blackman was legendary for being a hard guy. Colonel Bice, B-I-C-E. And the regimental commander was General Sheehan, who was no slouch. And then we got Blackman and Ray Smith, you know. So it was just a constant reinforcement of good, you know, good leadership. And I'll never forget that, getting all that shit together and then, you know, that organizing that thing. And then off it went, you know, trying to find that girl. But him just telling me, he gave me a couple of mission orders and, you know, and he trusted me to do it. And because we had good staff and COs and shit, you remember Staff Sergeant, he retired as Sergeant Major Brisbane. Well, he was the boat, like staff and CO, and he did everything. He did, you know, our boat, 3/8 boats, you know, but yeah. So that's my story. I'm sticking to it.
I wish I could remember who influenced me on this, but I remember being at the basic school. It's probably the discussions that we had. And the maneuver warfare was the big thing. Right. And, you know, and how would the Marine Corps do this and all the rest of that stuff? And I became the leader of this thing that I called the B team. And it was like, so we had guys that were like big into like, so Bill Lynn said that our wars had to be all complete free play.
Yeah.
And I said, fuck that, because they'll get lost and they won't make contact. And then the ammo turn-in on Friday is going to take 15 hours. I don't want to be around for that. So fuck it. I won't sign up for that shit. And I wouldn't. And they would put me on the board for it. So I become the ringleader of all these little assholes who believe the same thing. And we tended to be guys who love squad tactics. Freddie was a part of it, right? And I can't remember who else. Lenny Echo was. He was like, "I'm a B team guy, man. I don't want to be on the war. I don't want to be on the wars because we don't make contact, man. We're like maneuverists in the mist."
I remember that.
So yeah. And so one of the things I learned was in all this discussion of maneuver warfare, I learned how to segment like the critiques we'd do, the AARs, so that we would not get lost in this cerebral maneuvering shit, and that there comes a point when we begin to execute.
Right.
And when we execute, we are United States Marines, man. We are assholes about execution. So I don't care what happened inside your brain to get you to the line of departure, tell us we're going that way. Once we cross that line of departure, you better be a United States Marine, and you better be kicking somebody's ass, and you better be doing it right, or you better have a good explanation why you couldn't, because we're going to be assholes about execution. So it was this – I learned kind of from my peers this cerebral like divide of, okay, give us your estimate of the situation. Why did you do this? Anybody got any questions? We're not going to play what if. What if the enemy's here? What if, ask him a question as a subordinate. Okay, did you mean this or that? I meant that. Okay, and then later on we'll say, okay, why did you think that? That's one part. And then the other part of the AR was, all right, how did we execute the movement to contact? And you had to be a ruthless prick about that, right? Yeah. Why did we do it? What are we supposed to be doing? Why wasn't your cami done? Why wasn't the gun position here? Why didn't you report when you were supposed to report? And so you had to be this kind of Jekyll and Hyde. But it emphasized was our discipline as Marines in execution. That we could be skipping. And I wish I could remember who said this. We can be skip and go naked all we want. And we can be maneuverous all we want. But at some point, somebody's going to get online to kill somebody else. And we better be fucking great at that, or we're going to pay too high a price for that which we achieve. And that discipline and execution, to me, I think, had a huge impact on me. You know, I mean, just all the things that you do. You know, your cleanliness as a unit. That's preparation for combat, because there's a certain way we fucking do it, right? And it's your statement about you. And I think that's operational discipline. But I think it really got showed to me home to me at the basic school, where we did so much of it, and trying to impart on lieutenants, right? Okay, we can have this incredible conversation about decision making and tactics and whatnot, but once we flip the switch and now we change the critique and we're talking about execution. Asshole city, man. And you better be good at this shit, because if you can think but you can't execute, you're going to be in the right place at the right time, right? And you're going to get your ass kicked. If you can execute but you can't think, you're going to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and you're going to be executing your ass off, and you'll be irrelevant. You got to be able to do both, and you got to be disciplined to be able to do both. So I thought that was that was one of the lessons I learned from a lot of my peers. These three guys were all part of that, and that I thought really has benefited me in my life, as well as a Marine officer.
I agree with you. It was whoever was in charge of that, the exercise design for the war, the idea of putting a basic school instructor as one company commander, basically two basic school instructors who had experience as the company commanders going, and they divide the company in half. And if the company was small enough, they would do where they put EI company as the enemy, you know, to one of the other companies that had a TBS instructor as the company commander. And Will was our company commander in EI company. We got to do it against Bravo company in, I think, 91 or 92. And I'll tell you what, for me and Will, it's like old home week. We were doing just same shit we were doing in 3A, except without AAVs. And it was a joy to do it. And more importantly, it was the way they engineered it, Mac, with that, to not have it be where maneuvers in the mist, where you're not clashing with each other, but where the missions, you know, and the orders made us have to lock horns so that you could actually have a good.
And that and that's what it evolved,
you know,
to.
Good,
yeah, that's what it evolved to. The initial right. form of it was painful. Fuck.
I bet.
I saw Fitz. I saw Fitz one day, and it was in one leg of the war, and it had rained all night. It was one of those really shitty nights in February, March, where it's like 35 degrees, just warm enough not to snow, and then it does the flash flood thing, and Fitz was trying to infiltrate. He's with Larry Zell trying to infiltrate some bullshit, right? And they're moving all night, and like nothing's as it was because all the creeks have risen and all that. And we're at, and then in the morning we're trying to talk them on to where we're at. Like no. And so when I finally see Fitz, he looks like E.T. when they found E.T. down in the river, right? And he's all gray looking and shit. I look at Fitz. I said, Fitz, are you okay? And he's like, Mac, I'm miserable, man. I think I'm gonna die. I'm like, suck it up, man, or come to the defense. It's a better way. It's a better form of. It's a better form of warfare. Oh my god! Oh my god! But it was maneuverous in the mist. It was complete free play, the lieutenant, and it was just stupid. And then they evolved it to what Jeff's talking about, which is a smarter way to do it.
Interesting. Yeah. When Jeff and I were at EI Company, we did that with lieutenants twice. And right. And I would say that our significant advantage in EI Company is that we could execute, because we had staff NCOs and NCOs.
That you could actually
so
what?
Orders were much
execute.
Execute.
We could execute because we had staff NCOs and NCOs. So word went up and down the chain of command, right? Lieutenants didn't know how to be truly squad leaders on platoon sergeants. And we actually had them. And we could operate really, really fast because
yeah,
of
it. Was great.
So.
What was good about it was it started out, EI Company was small because it started on Thursday. And then we got, because we had other commitments we had to do for IOC, for other companies. And then as the weekend came, we were at our apogee on Saturday and Sunday. And then Monday, we were getting small again. By Tuesday, we had like 35 guys and me and Will pinned up against the the side of the hill. Going down like the Japs at Saipan, man. The only thing we didn't do is jump off the cliff there at the, on the endurance course.
That's awesome. No, I mean, but it's that hardness of execution that I think is quintessentially, is that kind of chip on your shoulder that, yeah, we'll stay here and do it all day, but it was kind of interesting because the base school was very cerebral and maneuver warfare. What did this mean? Like, and it was even interesting because I remember going up and I got the term German troop leading manual. And I'm like, look, the Germans don't strike me as skip and go naked people. And I can't believe this shit Bill Lynn's telling me is true.
He's a skipping.
They did. Initiative everywhere. It's like it can't be like that. And I remember Zinni coming and doing his PME, and man, I thought that's why I call him the Burning Bush. He abused Bill Lind all night. It was hilarious, and is what we certainly needed to hear. But to intellectually question this as military professionals about how in the fuck does this lay down? If everybody exercises their own initiative, when is the main effort the main effort? And if you're part of the main effort, do you have any right to deviate from that mission? Or are you locked into it because you're the bid for success? And so that's how our relationship began, for those of you who don't know. We would go to these mucus meetings and we'd argue about this shit. No, you can't. Right? You're the bid to victory. You can't deviate at all. Like, why can't you? And so, but it was that intellectual rigor, but then that equally that hard attitude about, hey, look, I know what you fucking thought. But I'm watching what you do, and you suck, man. Get your head out of your ass and get your right and get your ass moving. You're a United States Marine. Be one. And they were like, "Oh shit, man, this guy's serious about this shit." So yeah. Anyway, no, it was fun. It was fun, and it was great. It was a great learning experience as a leader too about what it truly takes to be good. And to be good, you got to be good at executing. And I don't care what the fuck you're doing. We were talking about painting rocks earlier, right? That's your statement about where you live. Raking sand, painting rocks, putting ropes up, right? And this might be a shithole, but guess what? It's our shithole, and it's going to be shiny. It's going to be squared away. It's going to be a squared away shithole. Well, that's your statement about you. The way you execute, right? The way your duty NCO, right, stands up and either salutes or doesn't. That's a statement about who you are, what you are as a company and an organization. And when you see shit, right, start flipping rocks, and you're gonna find it. All right, let's talk books, leadership books. Will, you have a favorite leadership book?
number one leadership book of all time is Starship Troopers. It's
not a bad
fiction,
one.
Fantasy, et cetera. No, but when you read that thing, Heinlein gets to leadership in all kinds of situations. Leadership in how you recruit, leadership in how you train recruits, leadership in how you develop NCOs and junior officers, leadership in how you lead junior officers, leadership in how you discern what the true essence of a mission is, leadership in setting the example, being a man, et cetera. It's the greatest leadership book ever written. Starship Troopers by Robert Heinlein.
Whoa. The greatest. That was an unequivocal statement. All right. Tim, greatest leadership book in your opinion?
I'm going to reach back to those mucus meetings because I remember pulling this one out way back then, and it was William Slim's Defeat into Victory. One of the best books written by a retired general. I mean, it ranks up there with Ulysses S. Grant's memoirs. That's not me saying that. That's what the internet says. But Slim, who was not a favorite of Churchill's, who had to deal with all kinds of internecine warfare on his side with the American Stillwell and with the long-range patrol groups, which he thought were worthless, which might be why I like Slim so much. He thought all that special reconnaissance and all those advanced forces were just a goddamn waste of his time and people's lives trying to go after him. But the way that he took defeat and changed it into victory. The Japanese had driven their asses out of Burma by the time Slim came and got hold of that thing. And it took him took him over a year, which isn't long now with the 20 years of Afghanistan. I guess it seems like it took him just a wink of an eye.
Right.
But it was a long slog to rehabilitate that combat unit. And the lessons learned, even when we were captains back at TBS, were pertinent. And I haven't read it in a long time. But I remember thinking, well, ever since, it is by far the best military memoir I've ever read. And I'm generally not a fan of the Brits, to be perfectly honest, but I'm a fan of that one. He writes a hell of a tale, and it was a hell of an accomplishment what he did to the Japanese.
Got it. All right, Jeff.
Yeah, I have to say, I think the best leadership book for me that I read over and over again whenever I'm on ship is the Bounty trilogy, Mutiny on the Bounty, Men Against the Sea, and Pitcairn's Island. And the reason is because everyone knows the general story of the Mutiny on the Bounty. Either you saw the movie with Clark Gable or you saw the movie with Mel Gibson, or the one, the really stinkeroo one in between with Marlon Brando. But what's fascinating about it is the same characters in different situations. I mean, we kind of talked about it, the need to be a loyal followership is part of leadership. And, that is delineated out in the first part of the trilogy, Mutiny and the Bounty. And then they put the captain Bly on the open boat, basically the life ship, the Bounty, and with some loyal sailors and officers, and off they go. And there's no chance that they would actually survive, but they did. And they did because the leadership who was mutinied on because of, supposedly because of his bad leadership. The only thing that made him survive was that. And he survived, and most of them lived. And then finally, the Pitcairn's Island is about the mutineers. They scurry away. They found an island that only delineated by a latitude. It wasn't like, in other words, we think there's an island along this latitude somewhere. And they found it. And I think their ancestors live there to this day. But basically it was, and every lesson that we talked about is delineated in this trilogy. Like they basically fall to feuding, as they say about the Hatfields and McCoys, on Pitcairn's Island, because they don't get along with each other, because all the things that in supporting the mutiny and supporting the troops' rebellion against Captain Bligh, it came back to haunt them, and they couldn't maintain good order and discipline on that island. They end up murdering each other. And, not totally, of course, but to me, that's a very good – I read that book, Bounty Trilogy. I read The Kane Mutiny, which is another great book, by Herman Wouk, his first book, actually. And I read Moby Dick, I mean, I always took those books with me on every float since I was a lieutenant, and I'll do it. I'll try and read them once a year now. I don't really get to anymore, but you're inspired on board ship. There's nothing else to do, really. You know,
quite the nautical reader you are.
Well, yeah, because it's just, you're right. It doesn't really have anything. There's a million books. I mean, I hear you guys say all these books, and I'm like, they're absolutely right. You know, but I have to tell the truth. As far as repeated reading over and over,
right.
You know,
right.
There's those three for sure.
Yeah, I would say the book that I would say influenced me relative to leadership, and I think it tells a story about the Marine Corps, and I think Marine Corps leadership, and that is Fehrenbach's Kind of War.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, and to me, you know, the simple virtues, you know, that the Marine Corps has practiced over the decades of, you know, being first, you know, landing with a thud and being pretty cost effective, and probably foremost being a disciplined fighting force. And to me, Fehrenbach's book, I remember somebody recommended that to me. I'd really never heard of it, and I considered myself, you know, I was a fairly well read person, but you know, I'd never read that. And I read it, and I could not put it down when I started reading it. And the story is a gripping story about really disaster in Korea, pushed down into the Pusan perimeter, and then just the incredible story of, you know, of Marines, the discipline and the will, you know, to win, and you know, that proves it stabilizes the Pusan perimeter, right? The you know, the 1st Marine Division goes ashore at Incheon, and then everybody else breaks out of Pusan, and then we go up to the Chosin Reservoir, and we do that as well. And so to me, it's this incredible epic about leadership in difficult times, and what sustains, because you can, a disciplined force can sustain a lot of bad decisions, because they'll fight their way through that stuff. And so to me, and I link this kind of to my last point, and that is this: if you're not disciplined, right, you're short for the world. Right. And I'll tell you what, and I think the Navy is living that nightmare right now, in that they have not so much embraced the discipline of military life. Right. That, you know, it's like you could do this, you know, this, and they've got to get back to it. And so to me, Fehrenbach's book is one of the great reads about discipline and why the United States military needs to be a disciplined fighting force, and why all that chicken shit that people say, oh, it's just bullshit. It ain't bullshit. It is the makings of mental toughness. It is the makings of a disciplined fighting force. It is the making of organizational discipline. And when you begin to a la carte discipline, right, that's when you step on the road, right, to hell as a fighting force. So to me, Fehrenbach tells that story in spades.
Yeah, you know, when I was in the ACMAC's office, General Dunford, there was an expression that came up relatively often was in regards to readiness. You know, are we going to be Task Force Smith, or are we going to be the fire brigade? And so it resonated, what's that, 60, 70 years later.
Wow.
Yep.
All right, we'll go around one time. Two guys who you know, right, that you look up to as leaders, one Marine and one civilian. Will?
Marine is a guy named Jim Twilliger, CWO3 retired. He was my gunner in my battalion in Iraq. And it's funny, when we were getting ready to deploy, you know, division came back summer of 3, and all of a sudden in December of 03, we're going back in 04. And I didn't have a battalion gunner in 1st LAR because, you know, the geniuses on high said I didn't need one, even though I had a mortar platoon with no 0848. I had 117 machine guns in a battalion and no 0331. And so I bitched, moaned, and complained, said I need a gunner. Well, there's no gunner. Williger shows up in my office about 3 days before I deploy, and I threw him out. I said, fuck you guys, I'm not going to take a gunner. And he persevered and stayed there. And this guy was – He was actually, I think, an 0351 in General Dunford's company, then Captain Dunford. Then he went to Force Recon, and he had, I think, 10 kids at the time.
What?
And he was the absolute quiet professional. And he could have been my battalion three. He could have been the best squad leader in a battalion. He could have been the sergeant major. And he was, you know, he's almost my age. Our sons were the same age and went to boot camp together. And that guy was just a consummate Marine professional with a sense of humor and pound for pound, one of the absolute toughest guys I ever know. I always looked up to him. And on a civilian side, I'll tell you, a guy I look up to a lot as a leader is my father. Started a business in the late 70s. You know, think of Carter era. And my dad is like an engineering genius. And I just, as I would talk to him and how things were going in the business, I saw things about setting the example, setting high standards, recruiting good people, trusting people to do things. And then the final thing he did, he built this business, and he didn't retire until he was 78 years old. And he basically turned it over to a couple of guys that had worked there for a while. And it was funny, the last time I was there, he was telling me, you know, we had a really good year. And the guys he turned it over, he said, they may not have been able to start the business, but they run it better than I did. So there's a guy that ran a business for like 40 years and was still humble enough to say, you know what, there's people out there that could do it better. But I learned a lot from him, just sort of talking how he ran the business, and look up to him for that.
Interesting. Interesting. Timmy?
In the military, I mentioned him already. He'd be Colonel Mike Lowe. Now, you might remember him, Mac, and or all three of you. He was our monitor when I was a lieutenant.
Yeah.
He was the 03 monitor. Right?
Right.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Big, tall guy, skinny from South Carolina, smoked Marlboros, which was unusual for officers to do back then. Very unusual, as a matter of fact. And had the funniest sense of humor I think I've ever seen on anybody on active duty outside of maybe Paul Kennedy. But I think he was funnier than Paul. And that's saying something. And but he was also a consummate professional. And God, if he couldn't get every last ounce of whatever it was that he wanted out of you, he could milk it out of you without any effort whatsoever. And he was also within the battalion. He was the continuity that made everything kind of flow. You know how sometimes that can be an XO, sometimes that could be a battalion commander. It kind of depends on the personalities. And the way that ours worked out, it was him that was the mainstay of the battalion's sense of itself as a professional organization. And I just enjoyed the hell out of him because he maintained a sense of humor in the face of any and every disaster that could befall a peacetime training establishment, which are many, you know, myriad and some minor, some not, but never failed to maintain that sense of humor, particularly when things were really grim. And I've always thought that was an important thing to do if I ever found myself in a situation where things were pretty grim. And it worked. And on the civilian side, I would have to say Steve Scholes. Steve Scholes is the founder and owner of a Central Asia Development Group. He's a former Special Forces and enlisted guy working out of Singapore now, where CADG is based. He was my boss when I was doing all that community development work in Afghanistan, and he was working in Afghanistan exporting pomegranate when the Taliban were in charge. He was one of those guys who got into Singapore, recognized there were opportunities that weren't being serviced, one of them being, you know, high-quality pomegranates, because Afghan can definitely do that, and was in Afghanistan well ahead of us and was really able to develop a world-class organization based on his taking, you know, putting his ass out there to be the first guy to go in there and tell the Taliban, hey, I want to do business. I think we can make money. And once they figured out that's what was going on, he had no problems. He used to talk about driving through Helmand Province, Farah, all those places. No issues at all in the Taliban times, which is just weird. But I had to admire his drive and initiative. And in an industry where the watchword was fraud, waste, and abuse, his company finished every project on time and on budget without exception for 2 years running, making us the turds in the USAID punch bowl because nobody else could do it. And they fucking hated us because we would turn it – every time, up, we're done. Here's the pictures. Go look for yourself. It was a lot of fun working for him. But I admired his grit and determination to start a business where nobody thought there was any business to be had. I got to love an original, you know?
Got it. Jeff, 2 liters.
Yeah, the first one's that Gunnery Sergeant Step, who was my NSRIC in Iran and then my company Gunny in 3-5. And, you know, he passed away in 2008. He retired from the Marine Corps in the mid-90s after he had done he did Desert Storm as the first sergeant of Weapons 3-7, I think. So that guy was just he knew everything about being an infantry, you know, Marine, and he really, he was very set the example type guy. He was the type of guy who, if he knew there was adversity above our rank, he would step in without thinking and take it. Like, he would never let us deal with stuff above our pay grade. And at the same time, you know, he developed pride within the unit. I mean, stuff I didn't see until I became an officer among most other staff and COs. You know, he was that good. And then the civilian, I have to say my mom. I was going to say my dad. You know, I love my dad. My dad, I admire him. I think about him every day. He passed away in 2013. And I think I'm more like my dad than my mom. But my dad's the type of guy who wouldn't take shit from anybody. I mean, if he's ever mugged, he'll be dead. He will not give up anything, you know. But my mom, she is like, she's coming at you, and you better do what she says. She was a driver. She taught us how to read, me anyway, when I was like 4. I'll never forget it. You know, I mean, the big M's and O's and P's and her face, you know, glaring at me. You will learn this, Jeffrey. You know, and you have potential, and I will squeeze that potential out of you. No matter how miserable it makes you, and you know, I mean, it doesn't sound good, but it was good. And you know, I'll tell you, you know, she was like that. She was teaching me and my sister how to read. So I finished my part, and my sister, she was, this is just an illustration. My mom's got these flashcards with prepositions and shit on them. And so she goes, "What's this word now?" My sister's 2 years younger than me. She was like 6 at the time. "What's this word?" Or 5. "What's this word, Mary Ellen?" And it was there, T-H-E-R. "There." "And what's this word?" "Here." "And what's this word?" "Those." "And what's this word?" "Them." And the next word my mom holds up is this. And Mary Ellen goes, "It's the here." And my mom looks at, "How do you get here? This word is this, Mary Ellen." And so she goes through the whole thing again. And she gets to this, and Mary Ellen goes, "Here. You are messing with me, young lady." Smack. And my sister's crying over thinking, what kind of a jerk doesn't know that there's this and here? And my mom, though, we read before we went to school, which was a huge time. And everything else too. She would, she would not settle for mediocrity and stuff like that. And it was, so I did good in school. You know, I got thrown out of school every year, from the sixth grade on for fighting at least once. But I had good grades, you know, and it was because of my mom. And if she never hardly ever needed backup from my dad, you know, and, it was, she's, you know, a remarkable person. She's still around. You talked to her a little bit, Mac, on the phone there. She comes off a lot. She comes off much more reasonable. And I don't want to give the impression that she's, you know, like a crazed Nurse Ratched type. But let me tell you, when she wants me to do something, I just fucking do it, you know? And because of that, I was whatever meager success I have in my life, I pretty much owe it to my mom's, self-discipline and drive.
That's awesome. Military leaders, I got the chance to meet General Zinni as a captain through our arguments at the basic school. And then he came and spoke, and then I used to bug him. I'd call him. So I got to know him. And to me, I feel like General Zinni is always been a consummate leader. He's got a funny sense of humor. He's smart as a whip. And then, you know, to the run up to the war in Iraq, I mean, I thought he was an articulate dissenter and lived up to, you know, the oath that we take. And I call him the burning bush, and I still, you know, I still talk to him. And so to me, I mean, he's somebody I've always looked up to, and I'm proud to say that I know him. The other guy, though, but I didn't know him as a military guy, but he was a Marine in Vietnam, is Jack Riley. And he's a guy who I've interviewed a number of times. He's a squad leader at Getland's Corner. But since he's come home, right, he got called twice by the VA, told once he worked in Agent Orange for a year. And he's probably going to have physical issues because of it. Next call was, hey, you were at Camp Lejeune, so you got that water in you. It's contaminated. And all that guy has ever done in his life is give to other people. He's taken he ordered DOS floppy disks of phone books from every state in the country so he could organize the first reunions that India Company 39 had. And he's been doing that his whole life. So he's been a huge inspiration to me. And he was post-traumatic winning, you know, a long time before I ever did anything. And so I have incredible respect and admiration, and he's a role model for me. Somebody who'd never served that I've always looked up to is my Uncle Jim. My Uncle Jim was like one of the great guys in my town. He was kind of like George Bailey, but he was meaner than George Bailey is. But he helped everybody. He helped everybody. He didn't take a whole lot of shit from people that he didn't tolerate idiots well. But, I mean, if somebody was sick, right, my Uncle Jim would come by the house selling Chipino dinner tickets for somebody, some fundraiser for somebody who had cancer. Or if somebody needed a job or like a ticket fix, he was a clerk of the court in Sacramento. And he would, quote unquote, fix a ticket. Well, you know what he would do? If he liked the person, he would pay for their ticket. Because you can't, unless you want to get fired, you can't go out there and pulling out tickets and like, yeah, write this one off, Helen. It doesn't work like that. But, and he had a huge impact on me as a kid because, you know, my dad left every spring, was gone for about 6 months. And my Uncle Jim would always come for me. I used to hang out with he and my cousin Tom. And he never forgot me as a kid. And I used to be in the hell of three sisters and my mom, and he would come get me and take me. And then as I became an adult, I saw how involved he was in the community and how devoted he was to his friends and the causes that he cared about. And it made a big impression on me. I mean, when I ran for city council, I mean, I had my Uncle Jim in mind in terms of, you know, this is how you do good for your community. You take your leadership and you get involved. And so my Uncle Jim. All right, any safe thoughts? Or hold on, we have to go around the wheel. What are you reading? What are you reading, Will?
I'm still reading that book, Common Sense Nation. I think I talked about it last week or the week before.
Got it.
We look at the founding documents. Good stuff.
Tim, what are you reading?
I am completing the James Horn Fisher extravaganza. I'm reading Neptune's Inferno, which is about the invasion of Guadalcanal from the Navy's perspective.
All right, Jeff, what are you reading?
Yeah, I'm finishing up that book, The Real Lincoln, and I'll have to talk to you guys about it offline before we want to talk, because it really is more of a cynical view of President Lincoln. It's well written and it seems well researched and everything, but it makes President Lincoln out to be much more of a politician than he is in our history. He's venerated now, and I think he deserves that veneration. And it brings up the subject of, you know, there's some people who do amazingly selfless things, and it's the only thing they did in their life that was that way. It's like I don't know what possesses them, you know, but their prior history doesn't lead up to it. You like to think that there's people just do good all the time. But what happens as much is that you have a person who's pretty sometimes not so good at all. And then something gets into them. I don't want to get religious or anything because I don't know if that's what it is, but they perform something that's noble and selfless, and they're known for that act. And I think it's just that they're known for that act. You know, that's a just thing. And so also I'm going to have Will text me. I keep forgetting the guy's name who wrote that book, because I'll tell you, I'm interested in the Holocaust thing. You know, I mean, I've read a lot about it. And what gets me the most about it is, you know, I'm not as skilled as Thunder. I know he finished it. But the thing is about how, with such practicality and, you know, an initiative, they perpetrated such a horrible act. It's just interesting to me. You know what I mean? And also, I'm going to read all those books by the guy who wrote The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors. And Timmy just mentioned his name. But it's one of those names that I can't keep in my head.
Hornfisher
or something like that.
Hornfisher.
So,
no, you know, I'll do it. And I keep bugging Will because I can't remember the guy. I can't remember the name of the book or the guy who wrote it about the Holocaust. So about every 3 days, somebody will message me or email me and say, hey, what was the name of that book? So,
right.
Testament to Will's literary power over the over our audience.
So just text it to us, Will, because I'll never remember it.
Yeah, neither will I.
Martin Gilbert.
Oh. The Holocaust by Martin Gilbert. I'm not reading anything. And let me just tell you, I have the, to me, it's quite an honor, but, doing post-traumatic winning with the 15th MU this week, got a chance to spend some time with our friend, Chris Bronzy, who's their commanding officer. But, and just another incredible experience where you get a chance to meet these Marines and sailors. And let me tell you, you know, what they're going through with their schedule and how this thing all puts together is not easy with the COVID thing and all the other restrictions. And it's just, I would say, a bit of a nightmare. And in the middle of it, you know, the battalion goes down to the border and spends 90 days on the border in the middle of their workup. And so, anyway, it's been interesting and always a great experience to get to know young Marines and listen to the things that they have to say. So I haven't been reading anything. I've been doing that. So anyway, all right, boys, thank you very much for the visit. As always, have a great week, and we'll talk to you next week. That'll do it on a Thursday. Thanks for listening. Don't touch that dial. Hour one is coming up next. It's a progress report, kinda, on how my week's going. But as I said, the more I do post-traumatic winning, the more I'm convinced that it is spot on. It's evolution, and all the people that have contributed to it. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool to see young people. And again, it's pretty cool to see young people that have a whole variety of issues that they deal with. And then to watch them. And then talk to them about, you know, how you transcend that stuff. What are the tools? What are the things you need to do in life where you transcend those events? And so it's just on a regular basis. It's just it's the most wonderful experience. I don't know any other way to explain it than that word. Is to see young people, honestly, anybody. And I've gone through this recently with Stacy Falzerano, right? My friend who was raped twice. And then it keeps happening, right? The emails I've gotten just from these Marines that have gone through it the last couple of days. And it's just a wonderful experience. And so you'll hear me talk a little bit about that in hour one. An abbreviated hour one. It's only 30 minutes long. So, but a busy week for for post-traumatic winning. And so anyway, thanks for listening today. I love these kind of conversations that we just did about leadership. If you have a topic that you'd like us to discuss, let me know. Because I think, you know, one of the things that we discussed was something that applies to everybody. And that was, how do you deal with death? And something that, you know, that the four of us have a fair amount of experience with. And I can't tell you how many people have reached out to me and say, hey, I listened to that. And thank you for doing that. It was as difficult as some of those discussions are. I thought it was a wonderful discussion and I learned something. And so I like talking about these issues. So if you have something that you'd like us to talk about, let me know. I'd love to talk with them longer about discipline. I'd love to talk to them longer about, maybe we'll do a show about dissent. How do you dissent? And give me examples of it. And so I think those are interesting discussions as a professional, because you're not obligated to see eye to eye with everybody. But, you know, in a hierarchy, somebody says yes and no, and when you get to that point, right, you nod your head and you say aye aye. That's known as the salute point. And then you go and you execute that to the best of your ability. Prior to that point, you owe them your honest opinion. And you're supposed to be part of the discussion. So, but that's a lot of times that's easier said than done. Easier said than done. So, I really like these discussions. And as you can hear, we've been doing this since like 1990 together, you know, off and on throughout our lives. And so it's fun to do it with them, because the thing I love about this group, and this group is reflective of a wider group, and it is they're wicked smart, wicked funny. Yeah, and that's really a fun, it's really a fun group to be around. So anyway, thanks for listening on a Thursday. Have a great day. All Marine Radio, out.